second, Cindy, please call the roll.
Certainly, council members present and establishing a quorum are Scarborough, Quebec, Rasmussen, Young, and Gamble.
Great, and Councilmember Davis had indicated that he would not be here this evening at a prior meeting. We'll consider him as excused unless there's objection to that. And we don't have a word yet from Councilmember Davis. We'll announce for the record when he comes in. Councilmember Quinn, will you please say something?
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic which stands one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
All right, the first item we have on our agenda this evening is a proclamation for Leadership Day. Whereas Leadership Snohomish County is recognized as the local organization specializes in developing leader, for a lifetime, making Snohomish County vibrant and providing education and opportunities for the past 20 years to strengthen our community. And whereas more than 100 employers in all sectors have participated in Leadership Snohomish County. And whereas in 2017, more than 600 Snohomish County professionals will have graduated from Leadership Snohomish County programs. And whereas Leadership Snohomish County intends to use Leadership Day to unite and recognize the role of leadership in our county and encourage community celebrations on this day as well. And whereas Leadership Snohomish County will undertake the recognition of this, of the many contributions from our community leaders across Snohomish County as part of this day, as well as coordinate the leadership service opportunity. And whereas this will be an annual recognition of the importance of leadership. Now, therefore, I, Jeffrey Thomas, do hereby proclaim October 14, 2017 as Leadership Day and encourage Monroe's residents and businesses to join in recognizing the contributions Leadership Snohomish County has made. This proclamation came about as a request from both the Snohomish County, from Leadership Snohomish County, rather, and also I know the council member Rasmussen went through this last year. Councilmember Rasmussen, would you like to say a few words?
I would. Thank you.
Hey.
I actually didn't come up here in a minute, but I just want to first introduce Kathy Cobb, the Executive Director of Leadership Snohomish County. Earlier this year, I proudly announced that I graduated from Leadership Snohomish County, class of 2017, best class ever. If you've ever been to a part of Leadership Snohomish County, you know what you'll understand what that means. So for those of you that don't know, this is a 9-month program that takes great leaders and puts them in safe environments so that they can experience the unique side of their own leadership abilities and test what they never knew that they had. It teaches us how we can be resilient by showing compassion or how we can be passionate about what we do while advocating to build a stronger community. Leadership Snohomish County provides an insight of the good that we as leaders can do to make a positive impact. See, during my 9 months, I gained a much deeper perspective on stuff such as healthcare and the troubles it's having, the fact that our justice system needs help, and a deeper understanding of how much children in our communities are hurting. Despite the troubling insights, there was comfort knowing that there were passionate leaders behind all these matters working to make positive impacts on the stuff that they have passion about. Leadership Snohomish County classes were also about more insight on our embedded social worker program and learned that there are positive alternatives to higher education for many of the students that we engage with every single day. All of these, again, being led by strong leaders within our own communities. But the conversation was a little bit more, a lot of glory. These leaders shined all throughout our classes. So imagine, if you will, take a director of a youth organization, an operations manager of a local healthcare provider, donor relations specialist, and a catering manager, put them together, team them up with a nonprofit, and say, make something great happen. That was the case for my team. We were assigned at home, HopeWorks, as they launched a new social enterprise. When we got the assignment, we found out that the newest enterprise was not going to move forward, but yet they had another brilliant idea. And as a team, we advocated with purpose for the reason for building a better community, while while staying authentic globally and showing resilience to those that challenged us. In the end, we took somewhat of a pie-in-the-sky idea, developed community engagement and feedback analysis that ultimately provided insight to what would be supported by the community for this worthy nonprofit. This is all done using gratitude and skills that we each brought to the team that we collectively learned during our time together in the Leadership Snohomish County program. When it was all over, we added one more tool to our belt. That was staying positive. I look forward to the day that Culinary Works opens its doors, and I plan to be there to celebrate the success of our team and the addition to another wonderful asset to our community. Leadership Snohomish County is such a valuable asset that we have right here in Snohomish County. I was proud to be one of only two representatives from East County, and this was out of a class of 50. I'm thrilled that our own chamber manager, our chamber director, is participating in the program this year, and as far as I know, she is our only East County representative. It's important to understand that this is a worthy and wonderful asset and opportunity that we have in our community. And celebrating Leadership Day is just another way that we can help promote this, the great leaders that we have. Thank the mayor for taking the steps to proclaim October 14th as Leadership Day, and I encourage everyone in this room to attend Leadership Day events. And we need more great leaders from the Monroe and East County area involved in this program, representing our community, and let other leaders throughout the county know that we are a big part of this county and that we're doing really well out here in Monroe. Kathy, thank you for being such an amazing leader in our community and allowing me to experience the program and be willing to share your passion, your expertise with everyone that you meet. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Ms. Hoppe, would you please come forward and present this proclamation?
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Thank you. Please look at the record show that Councilmember Hanford came in at 7:04, just after the proclamation was announced. The next item that we have on our agenda this evening is a proclamation from Monroe YMCA for the 10th anniversary. Whereas the Monroe YMCA opened its doors on September 1st, 2007, and over the last 10 years has walked side by side with the local community in their quest for help and wellness by in the way of financial assistance, scholarships, and affordable programming, having awarded $2.3 million in financial assistance. And whereas the Monroe YMCA partners with key community organizations such as Monroe Public School District, Evergreen Health Monroe, Monroe Rotary Club, CMAR, Providence Medical Monroe, and the City of Monroe to provide access to a fantastic YMCA facility and quality programming to the local community. And whereas as a nonprofit, Monroe YMCA values its partners collaborations allow us to do more together. And whereas the Monroe YMCA, with the help of the Monroe School District, has helped hundreds of preschoolers with school readiness through a summer jumpstart program, knowing that supporting our youth makes us all better. And whereas the Monroe YMCA believes in diversity and inclusion and prides itself on the members who walk through its doors every day, everyone is valued and brings a unique set of talents and perspective. And whereas the Monroe Y's journey over the last 10 years has impacted the lives of many with stories of health gains, confidence growth, reduced isolation, and an increased sense of belonging. And whereas the Monroe YMCA's mission is to inspire, nurture, and strengthen culturally vibrant communities through youth development, healthy living, and social responsibility. And whereas the Monroe YMCA is thankful for 10 years of impact and collaboration and is excited and optimistic for the next 10 years and beyond. Now, therefore, I, Jeffrey Thomas, do hereby recognize and congratulate the Monroe YMCA's 10th year anniversary and encourage Monroe's residents and businesses to participate in the YMCA's programs and events held throughout the year, and thank them for being part of Monroe's community. I do have Karen O'Meara Pullman here from the board to come forward and accept this. On behalf of the grateful community, we really appreciate all the work that you and the Y does. So thank you.
Thank you.
Great. We're going to move on to comments from citizens. This is the time set aside for members of the audience to speak to the city council on any issue related to the city of Monroe, except any positive issue matter that is subject to the public hearing. Testimony is limited to 3 minutes per speaker. And is anyone signed up to speak? Okay, is anybody that would like to come forward to speak to the city council this evening? Okay, seeing none, we'll go ahead and move on to the consent agenda. Council. Councilmember Rasmussen.
Motion to approve consent agenda.
Have a motion to approve the consent agenda from Councilmember Rasmussen with a second from Councilmember Cutback. Any discussion on the motion? Seeing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Abstentions? Motion passes 6-0. Thank you very much. We will now move on to new business. Item number one. This is AB 17150, ordinance number 021-2017, approving Raspberry Hill rezone, first reading. Mr. Swanson.
Before we get started, we check that this is a quasi-judicial item. Therefore, we will read into the record the appearance of fairness disclosure. Because the consideration of a site-specific rezone involves a public hearing and indicates that the land use rights of a specific landowner slash party proceeding is quasi-judicial in nature and subject to the appearance of fairness doctrine. This doctrine requires that such proceedings be not only fair in fact, but also in appearance. The legal standard under this doctrine is whether a disinterested person being praised all relevant facts would be reasonably justified in seeking a particular decision maker's interest or involvement in a case may affect his or her judgment. I will now ask City Council as a whole whether they have any disclosures regarding the following types of subjects. Any interest? Any items of impartiality? And any items of ex parte communication?
Councilmember Gamble?
Yeah. I do own property next to the rezone in question.
Thank you. Are there any others? Thank you. At this time, the floor should be open for parties of record to formally challenge any of the council members and the disclosures made. Pursuant to RCW 4236-080, challenges that are waived, they are waived unless they are raised promptly when the reason for the alleged disqualification becomes known. Are there any challenges? Thank you. Seeing none, please let the record show that there were no challenges made by parties of record. And this concludes the appearance of fairness disclosures. Thank you.
All right, so what we're going to do is we're going to go ahead and move on with this item. And please go ahead, Mr. Swanson.
Great, thank you, Council. So the proposed rezone in front of you is the Raspberry Hill rezone. It's RZ 2016-03. And just to orient you to the project site, here we have chain link road going along here. Down here is the track and the fairgrounds, and then the SR2 bypass. And so the proposed project area, they originally submitted a preliminary plat PRD in association with the proposed rezone. And so as standard in the consolidated permit process, we are running all these concurrently. And so with the preliminary plat, as we reviewed this, we bring forward the proposed rezone at the same time. This, the proposed plat is in anticipation of the rezone that goes along with it. And so I can skip that as well. So the actual project site, 18,500 Street Southeast area is currently zoned 9600, and they're proposing to change it to the R4 dwelling unit. And actually, this next slide should take care of most of it. The Planning Commission public hearing was held on August 28th. And so this is, as it's currently zoned today, at the UR 9600 level, the site area is approximately 4.9 acres with a maximum density of 3.63 units. And so based on its current zoning, it would be allowed 23 units. With the proposed rezone, it would increase that factor up to 26 units. And so a net increase of 3 units over the approximate 5-acre property. And as consistent with the comp plan, we do an analysis to ensure that it fits within that 3 to 5 units per acre that was adopted by the 2015 comprehensive plan. And the project site shows that the 5.29 units per acre, and under the MMC cited up there, under municipal code, we actually ground that down so it does meet the requirements of the minimum 5 units per acre. One thing in addition, I did hand out prior to the meeting some draft planning commission minutes, and this shows the citizen comments that took place at the public hearing. These have been approved, but I just want to give you a sense of what some of the citizen comments were. And generally, they were concerned about two things, and that was stormwater and traffic. Stormwater is something that is done at time of preliminary and final plat review to make sure that they're meeting their compliance with Department of Ecology stormwater guidelines. And so the city has adopted those stormwater guidelines and is current with Ecology's guidelines. And so those will be processed as we go through the plat. Traffic, this issue has come up with our past rezones. The city does comply with its concurrency requirements that were adopted in the 2015 comp plan, and the level of service analysis complies with that specific corridor there. And so those are also done at time of plat when we reviewed it, ensure that the roads can handle it. It's within the comprehensive plan limits for that specific area. And so those two analyses were done at preliminary plat, and we'll continue to review until final plat's approved. And so those are generally, you'll see just a summary of each of those comments in there. In addition to that, this is the first reading. The ordinance actually arrived at the city attorney a little late, so I'm going to be bringing it back for a second reading in front of council. He wanted some additional identifiers in the actual ordinance, such as the parcel number and the actual title of the ordinance. There is a typo in the staff report where it calls it legislative action as opposed to quasi-judicial action that we need to correct. And so I'll bring those back next time for the second reading and just identify those areas that we fix. And so with that, recommend that council accept first reading of ordinance 021-2017.
I have multiple lights. Can I start with Councilmember Gamble?
I just appreciate the presentation. I am going to recuse myself from any of the discussion of voting because I do own a piece of property right adjacent to this. So just in the fairness, it could be construed that I have a whatever interest, but I did want to see your presentation. So thank you.
Who's up there to show that Councilmember Gamble is up the chambers? Councilmember Gamble.
Thank you. So is there any reason why you couldn't wait until all the corrections have been made to do a first reading?
We could. I mean, we could bring it back later. We just as the feedback from the city attorney really appeared to be fairly minor as far as the corrections that needed to be made. So we're going to move ahead with the first reading and the second reading just to keep the schedule that we established with the applicant. But there, we absolutely could bring it back for another first reading.
I just would feel more comfortable.
Okay.
Yeah, all the eyes dotted and all the T's crossed. Just curious.
Thank you. Councilmember Kovac.
So when I was reading through this, I mean, the one thing that I was a little bit concerned with was under number 4, just the urban growth that there was adequate public facilities and services, and so is there two exits out of that development?
There is. And so this area that's zoned R4 up here, this is actually a D.R. Horton development. Okay. And so as they come in, they're building this road out and then connecting it through. Mm-hmm. And so you have these two points of access. Okay. And so they'll essentially, they're way ahead of this group coming through.
Okay.
So they'll essentially build this road out on this side of the street. They will put in their curb gutter sidewalk, but they will have access pushing through. And then when this group comes in, they'll finish out the second half of the street and solve the curb gutter sidewalk on their side of the street.
Okay, that's one thing. Looking up there with 191st still not done through, always being concerned with that there's multiple ways out of a new development. And then This is the first time I've seen the comments from the citizens, and that's something that we've had people come in periodically, more lately than not, with the development that's happening, and just kind of question, you know, is too much development happening, but, you know. So they originally put in for 28 units for that, and then changed it to 26. Was that because, obviously, when they did the calculations, it was 5.229, and then so...
Right. So, from my understanding, and this was, I believe, about 2 years ago, there may have been a misunderstanding between staff and the applicant on how many units they could actually achieve out of that lot. And so, I believe it came in, they initially anticipated more units than what was actually allowed on the acreage.
And so, when you round up, is it truly at a 5.5?
It's at the 5.29.
No, that is, so it's rounded down, but if it was 5.5, then you round up and it wouldn't...
It would boot it up.
Okay. I was just curious what that, if that was the limit. It's 5.49 and you round down.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
And then when reading through these notes, this is accurate that the traffic, is that what you were saying? The traffic will be considered when they're doing the plat?
Correct. And we already reviewed that. At time of preliminary plat, they're required to submit a trip generation analysis that the city reviews and then analyzes basically the level of service along those corridors that they'll be impacting to make sure that it still has capacity under that study that was done under the 2015 conference plan update.
Okay.
And so that's how we review for the traffic.
Okay. And then with the comments in here about the stormwater and the runoff,
mm-hmm.
So when will that be addressed?
So stormwater runoff, once that plat starts construction work on it, if there's, you know, pre-existing conditions that are essentially legal non-conforming, they've been around for years and that's the way they've operated, that's just existing conditions. However, once they start impacting the site and they start developing, we have very specific requirements from the Department of Ecology on how that stormwater is handled and runoff is handled too. And that goes up to, you know, things like the silt fence, like those black fences you see going along the perimeter property lines, detention ponds, even temporary detention ponds to hold that flow of water from going over. And so we have inspectors that go out on site, and that's their job, is they review the construction plan, and they're called the temporary erosion sediment control plans that they're required to have on site, and they also have things called SWIPs, these stormwater pollution prevention plans that also accompany it. So it's fairly heavily regulated from the start to the end, where you have to present these plans even before you start construction, plus you have to have a representative out on site that knows those plans or available within, I believe, 1 hour of coming out on site. And then our inspectors go through the sites and inspect them as the work's being done. Not only that they're doing the plan, but they're meeting these requirements of the stormwater.
And then, so the rest of the property to the right of it still will be zoned RU9600?
Correct.
Okay.
And just as, yeah, so these areas right here, all these R4s, these are, you know, largely the main view area through DR board, then this one has come in, haven't heard anything, but they'll still be the UR9600. And this is something, again, as we get out into our zoning code update, that we're gonna tackle as far as, you know, bringing a more uniform zone or uniform standard. Right now, it's Monroe's kind of in a weird place because you have this R4 and then you have this lot size, what was a lot size requirement with the UR9600. And so it almost has this mix of two different methods involved in it, and we're gonna smooth that out in the zoning code update.
Okay. All right. All my questions right
now. Thank you. Councilmember Starbuck. School district know that that street is going to go through?
Right.
Is the school district aware that street is going to go through and connect with that end in St. Clair Heights?
We send them all the, they're on our notice list essentially of when these plats come in, and so we notify them of each individual development. So we can, I mean, I can double check with them just to make sure.
Well, it will make a difference in transportation if they're still. Some other questions. The R4 above is part of the big development where it says R4, the Eagle Hunt or wherever they are. I don't have the information in front of me.
This one right here?
Yeah.
Yeah, so this one isn't an Eaglemont development. That's not a Mainview Home development. That's a DR.
Is or is not?
Is not. It's a DR Horton development.
So they're different homes than this over here?
Correct.
Okay. Enlighten me because I don't have the information in front of me. How many in the, is there 40 in the R4 there, the DR Horton?
DR Horton, this whole area will be 100 homes.
100. And how many over here in the R? How many in the Eaglemont?
Oh, in the Eaglemont?
400 or something?
Probably. I don't have my current development map, but yeah.
That's close enough. Okay, would it be safe to assume that the other lots next to the one we're talking about rezoning are going to come in with the same request?
Before the rezone?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because I don't stop it. Stay along to about the third one. And I know we talked to him about his taxes and whatnot. Mr. Dino, in his comments in this planning commission, the same gentleman was in talking about his concern about traffic coming off the hill and accommodating 400 something homes there, 100 something homes, another 40 down here. And I think he has a legitimate concern, and I didn't understand the explanation of why we're trying to do that, but I'm not sure we need to think a little more about Mr. Nemo and some of the other comments on this about the infrastructure to get people in and out of that area. Some of the walking around I've been doing and asking, there's a great concern about all of those homes in Eaglemont coming down and coming out of Sinclair Heights on Chain Lake, and the farm coming over into Chain Lake, and how busy it's getting that people can't hardly get on the Chain Lake. And one gentleman asked me, when are we going to put a signal there? And I'm like, oh, probably not for a while. So it is a concern of those people up there, and I think we need to, really know that there are, even though the planning commission says it's okay to give an extra few houses, you're going to get a few more there, you're going to get a few more on the next 5-acre lot, you're going to get a few more on each excessive 5-acre lot until they buy the big corner, and then it'll be another twice as many because that's a 10-acre. So I understand the public's concerns because it's like us watching the traffic on Overland Road increase when all the houses started being built up as a golf course. And it was nothing like what's being built in Eaglemont. I know there's an exit on Eaglemont on Chain Lake at the top that they'll finish. And I know that Eaglemont comes out of Sinclair Heights. And it will eventually come out on 191st. And 191st is 2019.
Believe that's when they're going to start going. I can double check on that.
Start. It's not the Google's 191st, 2019.
19. Those are my comments.
Thank you. Okay. Councilmember Kent?
Thank you. I think I spoke with the same person. Anyway, could you explain to me the road situation here? And then I want to go back to the very first map you have. Actually, let's do this backwards. Go back to the very first map you have. I just want to get some perspective on where we are. One more.
Yeah. Okay. So this is Chain Lake right here. And then track, bypass, and then this is the area where we talked about with those improvements and these houses building out, connecting this road through,
okay.
And then looping around, and then this is some of the existing access that they have.
So the roads that we're going to be that are going to be modified are, again, what are we adding?
So this right here doesn't it's a driveway
right
now, and so it doesn't really exist.
Right.
So this one, this 134th, will be modified into the two-lane road with parking, and so that will pull up, will allow traffic to exit through here and also through here. And then what this doesn't show is essentially main use development where they've gone in and also punched in their roads throughout this area, but you're right as far as it comes down here and then it goes to Chain Lake.
Right. Okay. Thank you. I just wanted to get a better perspective.
Yeah.
That's all.
Anything further?
No.
So, council members, you're presented with a motion for your consideration, and council member Camp.
Thank you. I still hold my original comment. If there's a way that we can wait, I'd like to have everything completed. That gives the council another week to think about it and review it. And I heard some good questions about traffic and stormwater. That would be my preference. And I'd like your others. Thank you.
Councilmember Cutback.
Is there a time issue?
The applicant, like all applicants, are.
They're anxious to get going. Would a week delay anything, though, for them?
I don't know their specific schedule. I couldn't tell you either way. I know they're anxious to get going. I don't know if a lot of money is riding on this, you know, this next week, or it's just we want to get moving forward with the project. I can't tell you. I can tell you, just like any applicant, they're anxious.
Thank you. Councilmember Hanford.
I'm fine with the first reading because it's going to come back, and this is planning commission's already looked at. This fits with them our comprehensive plan and trying to get density. So I'll go ahead and move to accept his first reading, ordinance number 021-2017, amending the zoning designation of a parcel comprising the proposed Raspberry Hill plat, urban residential 9600, UR 9600, two residential four dwellings per acre, R4, setting forth supportive findings, providing for severability and fixed in time when the same shall become effective.
Second.
Got a first from Councilmember Hanford, a second from Councilmember Cutback for the requested action as identified in the Agenda Bill 17-150. Discussion. Councilmember Scarborough, you're next.
Well, I'm going to go with Councilman Camp on this. I don't think that he was going to stop this project by anything. I'd rather have all our ducks in a row before we vote. So,
thank you. Councilmember Rasmussen.
Thank you. I'm fine with the first reading. It is just a first reading, and the ducks go on in a row, but if it comes back for second reading, we can make a decision to hold off then. So we move things along with first readings and take an action on the second before, and it's worked out just fine. So if we can get those check marks done, I'm fine.
Thank you. Councilmember Cutback.
Yeah, I agree with that. It's consistent with the comp plan. It meets the intent of the code. It is the difference of three homes, but I do think it begs a bigger question or discussion around access, traffic, 191st, all the development up there. So I will be voting for the motion tonight, but I think, you know, it warrants bigger discussion around development and what we're doing.
Thank you. Any other points of deliberation or discussion from council members? All right, seeing none, we'll go ahead and call for the question. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed?
Aye.
Abstentions? Okay, motion passes 3-2 with Councilmember Scarborough and Councilmember Camp voting against the motion. We'll go ahead and now ask that Councilmember Gamble return to chambers.
Liz, do you need the chair?
Please let the record show that Councilmember Gamble has now returned to chambers. We are now moving on to Councilmember reports. We'll be down the dais. Councilmember Gamble.
Hey.
I almost waited for you to say. We'll get back to your
preferred.
Okay. That's what we're getting. Cool.
Nothing. I just want to hear about the dance that's occurring tomorrow night.
You mean the world dance part? Cody?
Yes.
Are you going to come and show some moves?
I could. That's why I'm going to give up my time to let you have as much time.
That's okay. But it is a...
I have nothing.
Oh, well, I'm sure he'll come around the one.
Okay.
Does anyone else have something?
Nothing.
Okay, Councilmember Hanford?
Nothing tonight, thank you.
Councilmember Cutback?
Well, I'll answer Councilmember Camp's question. So the YMCA is having, at 4 o'clock, they're having a cake ceremony just to celebrate 10 years. And then at 5 p.m., there is free pizza from Sahara Pizzas. They donate once a month for members. Yep, tomorrow. And then from 6 to 8, it is a world dance party where you can come and instruct and show your moves. So I expect that we will see you there, Councilmember Camp.
Well, I see you there.
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I have a question. Was there any specific attire for the dance? Like, is it Zumba type attire?
I'm sure you'll see some Zumba attire. You will see. Yeah.
I just want to make sure Council is ready to go.
I have a feeling my Zumba days are probably long gone.
No belly shirts.
On that, Councilmember Cutback, do you think further?
No, I think
I am talking to you.
Coming back with Councilmember Campbell.
All right, John, you win. What's that? Well, a mix of football, and so we did have a football game, which was fantastic against the Over Cascade. Two undefeated teams, always a good cultural event. But also yesterday attended the curriculum night at the high school, and what was really cool to see is that it was the first time I've been in all the classrooms since they passed the maintenance levy, and to see all the new maintenance, the technology levy, and to see all of the new technology in the classrooms, it's unbelievable. So, just, you know, kudos to all of the taxpayers within the school district and within the city for having the foresight to pass that. You can just see teachers reading ear to ear and, you know, using latest and greatest. And what was awesome is there's no textbooks. It's not, you know, not having to take them home. It's all virtual. It's in the cloud. And it was really, really neat to see. So that was great. And then attended the Maroon Youth Football Auction on Saturday over at the Senior Center, which is just a great venue for those type of stuff. We had a guest auctioneer, G. Scott from 710 SPN, ESPN, that came up. And after we went on Friday, it was a very rocky. You know, it was a good crowd. It was good. So we raised about close to $28,000 to $30,000. That gets split between the youth football program and then the high school football program. So for new gear, and also we do a fund the need program so that we can make sure that no kid gets left behind on cleats and stuff that they can't afford it. So just a great night there. And then on Sunday, attended the Legends kickoff barbecue. So as crazy as that sounds, that we have a kickoff at the end of the fall time as we go into winter, because that's when the season starts and off season workouts. And when we were out there, it was at Sky River Park, and I was just thinking, man, it'd be so nice if we had power out here. So it's nice to see in the budget preliminary. It was just, you know, perusing thing that's one of the things we're looking at for improvements out there. I believe the Sky River overhangs and stuff like that in the park. Or stage area. That would be Lake Tai, right?
Lake Tai.
Lake Tai. Which is where we normally have the kickoff barbecue, but apparently it was tied up. So anyway, that, and then we have all the kids, the younger siblings and stuff, and thought, hey, we get swapped out on the playground equipment, which I know we did out of Lake Tai. We're talking about doing next year, so just a good week all the way around. Thanks.
Thank you. So having gone up to staff, the first person we have to speak from staff is Ms. Hasser for the finance report. Ms. Hasser.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. So in your packet was the August financial report, and as I think at this point it's starting to look familiar to you, I hope. I did notice as I was reviewing it this evening before I got up here that there were a couple of typos. It is 66.66% of the year at this point, and not the 58 that's still on to with pages. So just wanted to point that out. There is a new piece to the report, again, this ever-evolving report, and that is we are now starting to give you the investment report as well. We do have a pretty robust investment program here at the city, and as I outlined in the investment report, we do both short-term and long-term investments. Our investments are restricted by state law as to what we can and cannot invest in. So no, if you guys remember the 80s in Orange County, there's no derivative investing going on. Quite frankly, the majority, or a good chunk of it, is in investments that we can pull out same day if we needed to for cash flow purposes. So we don't get the type of returns that maybe you're seeing in your personal portfolios, but we also don't have the same risk. So. And then with that, I will just leave it to questions if you have for the finance report, because I think we're probably all curious about the little light reading I left on your diet. So.
Thank you. Councilmember Kinberg.
No questions this time, but I did want to thank you for the little notes off to the side of the arrows, the boxes, etc.
Thank you. Councilmember Kemp.
Thank you. Can we get an electronic version of this?
I can send it to you. Oh, that, yes. We're going to actually be put, well, you're getting ahead of me.
Well, I'm going back. I have no questions.
Please continue.
So, what you'll find on your dais there is the 2018 preliminary budget transmittal to you. By law, we're supposed to give you our revenue projections by October 2nd this year. However, since we do revenues, we might as well do expenditures at the same time. So what you have in front of you is a proposed balanced budget. I'm not going to go too into it at this point because we will be doing the public hearing on the revenues on October 3rd, which is the other reason we wanted to get it to you earlier and get it out to the public beginning tomorrow so people have a chance to digest it before the public hearing. And then the actual presentation on the budget is scheduled for October 10th. I do understand Councilmember Gamble will not be here, but I will extend the same offer that I extended to him here just a little bit ago. As you review this, if you have questions, please don't hesitate to ask me if you want to ask ahead of time. So having said that, there, you know, just it's kind of a new format from what you guys have had in the past. Of course, you have the mayor's message, and then beginning on page 8, there is an overview of the budget as a whole, as well as some spreadsheets to kind of give you all the funds in one spot in that particular section. And then the general fund actually begins on page 19, and the first page goes into our revenues. So that is the piece we'll be keying on for October 3rd, and it talks about what our revenues are, where they come from, and it gives you history back to 2013 on what our revenues have looked like in the past. Having said that, and to answer Mr. Camp's question, this budget will be available to the public beginning tomorrow. We're also going to have it on our website, so if folks want to download it from there, they can. I would ask you give us till the afternoon, because we do have to scan it in and get it posted out there. And if you would like, I will also send that to you electronically. We're going to want to break it up into pieces because it is quite a large document. So having said that, we are also going to be providing copies to the senior center and the library. So if citizens aren't comfortable coming to City Hall asking for it, they can certainly go to those two locations as well.
Thank you very much. All right, so we'll go ahead and move on to the next item on the agenda.
Thank you.
Thank you. The next item we have on our agenda this evening is the draft agenda for October 3rd.
Thank you. The items that you can look forward to, as Ms. Hatcher mentioned, is a deeper dive into the budget beginning on October 3rd, and then looking forward even beyond that on October 10th, we'll have the departments do their presentations to council on the budget. So this is just the beginning of the budget season, and I want to recognize all the work that Ms. Hatcher put into the budget document that you see in front of you. It's significantly different from the one that you've seen in past years. There's a whole lot more information in here, and hopefully we'll be able to move quickly through the the budget process. The other thing that we will be discussing with you on the October 3rd meeting is the Economic Development Advisory Board. This came out of the council's discussion several weeks ago. We're going to be presenting to you its purpose, the selection process, and a timeline. So you get a little more detail into the Economic Development Advisory Board as we move forward through the selection process. We'll have first reading of amending the critical areas ordinance, and then obviously second reading of the Raspberry Hill refund. All things to see on the October 3rd agenda.
Okay. Sounds good. Any questions? All right. And I'll thank the staff again next week, but as Ms. Knight pointed out, the department directors did a great job putting together the budget. Ms. Hassert did a great job putting together a new format that I think does a really good job of providing more information than we've had in the past. Ms. Knight, can you share that with the directors? My gratitude for the work they did.
Yeah, we'll do.
Thank you. Marie, that said, sorry, Councilmember Kovac.
Just, I didn't know if council wanted to move for next week's agenda, consent agenda number 3. It was the final reading of Raspberry Hill rezone. If we wanted, based on the discussion tonight,
I had already noted that was going to come back on second reading. I didn't say that, but had already noted.
Thank you.
I'll do that in the future and let you know if we're changing those things.
Okay, thank you.
All right. Thank you, Councilmember. All right, so we don't, what we're going to do now is we're going to go ahead and move into our discussion items. This evening we have our Parks Advisory Board here. Please note that we have made some modifications on how the microphones are working in here. We expect that they'll do a much better job of picking up discussion. And we're going to go ahead and take a 5-minute recess. We'll reconvene at approximately 8 to 10 minutes before the hour. So we are in recess for about 5 minutes. So we're still in the regular business meeting for the North City Council for September 26. We are now moving to the discussion item section. We have our Parks Advisory Board here, and one of the things that's important to recognize, we moved back down into the study session format. What that means is we're sitting down here, microphones are a little bit different, and we're going to ask that if you are going to speak, to try to make certain you've got one of these microphones kind of planted near you, you know, to the extent that you can pull it up and talk into it, that would be great. The way we'll do this format is a little bit more loose than up there, but at the same time, you know, just kind of raise your hand when you'd like to make our walk, we'll kind of call on you, and we'll just kind of go around like that. What I'd like to do right now is just go around the room and introduce everybody. This is both so that everybody can introduce yourselves to everybody here, but it's also for the recording. So we'll go ahead and we'll start with me, we'll work our way around. So my name is Jeffrey Thomas, I'm your mayor.
Jeffrey Knight, City Administrator.
Yes, we'll start.
Kate Bedevac, Council Member.
Jason Gamble, Council Member.
Jerry Rasmussen, Council Member from Yay Parks.
I'm not going to go down that road.
Jim Jack, Council Member.
Kurt Scarborough, Council Member.
Steve Whalen, Council Member.
Board member.
Karen Coverdall, Parks Board member.
Kevin Hanford, Council member.
We'll go on up to the staff and our consultant.
Thank you.
If you just introduce yourself, Mike, and the staff.
Mike Bell, Parks and Recreation Director.
Juliet Vong, HBB Landscape Architecture.
Bill Grimes, Council member.
Consultant, Studio Cascades.
Okay, so we're going to move on. We're going to go ahead and hand things over to staff. If you would like to say something or ask a question, just get my attention. And I thank you very much for all coming here today. Mr. Hill.
Thank you, Mayor. Good evening, Council and Park Board. So, just going to give you a little, just be real concise here. City of Monroe is creating two long-range master plans for Lakeside Park and for the Gavin site, which is adjacent to Skyward Park. Both plans will chart improvements, guide funding strategies, and help define the future of these parks. Two pop-up planning studios and two open houses were hosted for the community on September 15th and 16th at the Boys and Girls Clubs and at Lakeside Park, and the weather was gorgeous, so there were a lot of people in the park, and a lot of people that showed up at the Boys and Girls Club as well. So it was a really great opportunity to talk to a lot of people from the public, and they input. So they were well attended. In addition to the pop-up studios and the open houses, community members also have had the option to take an opportunity to take an online survey to answer questions and provide comments about their vision for the two parks. And the survey was open until September 24th, so that's been closed now. Our contracted consultant, HBB Landscape Architects of Seattle, have been condensing the data and ideas that the community brought forth and are here tonight to present the preliminary ideas to both the Monroe City Council and the Park Board. Next steps will include refining the concepts, more review, and public input with City Council adoption of the master plans to occur in January 2018. So with that, I want to introduce you to Juliet Vaughn. She's the principal of HBB, and also to Mr. Bill Grimes, and he is with Studio Cascade. Juliet.
Pretty exciting. It's a pretty intensive public process to get a lot of feedback and input, and so it's always fun to be able to kind of synthesize it all and convey that all out to you guys. And so I want to do, we've got about half an hour presentation, hopefully maybe a little less, but I want to take some time to go through some of the background that we did and what we presented at those pop-up studios, the questions we asked in those surveys, and some of the responses that we got, so you get that higher level perspective of what we've been hearing to date. Then we're going to go over what we heard in the pop-up studios, and then we're going to start looking at some detailed plans of preliminary ideas that we've gotten so far. Our goal is really to validate what we've heard with you guys and then also get some input on the direction that we want to move forward. So, with that, I think I'm just going to kick it off and let Bill get us started.
Okay, great. Thanks, Julia. We do need your help tonight. We're at a decision point in the process now, and we've heard a lot. We've had a lot of community conversation, and what we're hoping to do is to present some of our interpretations of what we've heard, and then get some feedback on where we need to go. I also think it's important for us to recognize that this master planning process, first of all, it's not really a design process. It's a master planning process. It's not starting from ground zero. We had a comprehensive plan process that the city went through a couple of years ago that also included the parks and recreation planning process. And I have to say, on a personal note, I'm thrilled to be back to be talking with you and learning how you're going to implement some of these goals and policies that you sought to put in your comprehensive plan. One of the things that was really important and resonated strongly with the community during that process was finding ways that we could interconnect our open spaces and also strengthen the community's association with the Skagit River. So getting that integrated more fully and completely into the community was an important principle, and also making sure we took advantage of opportunities to connect to other regional recreation and open space assets. And so when you're looking at Lake High and Cabin Site in that light, it really begins to cast the significance of the project that's underway now. One of the things that we have on display at the open house and the pop-ups was a historical board so people could understand a little bit more about the context, what was going on at Cabin, what was going on at Lake Time, how that related to different periods in the community's development. We also had some vision statements going in. Now, these vision statements were derived from your Parks, Recreation, Open Space Plan that you adopted in 2015. So it gave us a bit of a framework, but we needed to add a little bit of detail. This is something that we essentially created based on the Parks Recreation Facilities Plan and also other policies that the city's adopted. But we wanted to test these things and see if they were essentially pointing us in the right direction. But they began to speak to different types of essential functions that Lake Tahoe and the cabin site would begin to fulfill within the context of recreation in the Monaco community. But again, this was something that was essentially our interpretation of policy we have on the books, and we just wanted to make sure that the community would really get behind. That was part of our test.
Okay, so along with giving the background in the context of the planning that you've already done, we also think it's important to really understand the site itself and that immediate adjacencies, as well as how it's connected into the larger city. So this is just an example of what we did also have at the open house and the pop-ups, but really looking at the cabin site. And what I want to call attention to here are these blue outlines. That's probably one of the more important critical factors on each of these sites. That's the wetland boundaries. And wetland boundaries change over time. So we just had someone go out and actually flag and sketch in where we thought those boundaries actually are. We are in master planning phase, so some of this is not really all finalized. It's not fully documented, it's not fully reported, but it gives us enough information to make sure that when we do come up with a concept, it's based on some reality and some feet on the ground. So that gives us a pretty clear feasibility and understanding, particularly as we move into permitting and costs. Now I see some hands raised, Mr. Mayor, can I
help you? Sure. You want to go ahead and call people?
Okay.
So the blue areas is the... So the area contained within the blue is the wetland, or the area outside of the blue is the wetland?
So the area contained within the blue outlines is the wetland. So all of this area is the wetland, and there's some pocket wetlands here, there's a large system here, and there's some pocket wetlands here. But this is basically telling us, so in Kevin in particular, it's not just the wetlands and the features on the site, but it's also influenced a lot by the adjacent river. And so what this starts to tell us is, as you all are aware, this area floods. And so we also did take a look at really how the floodwaters come into the site, how they recede, what the direction of those flows are. And what's really happening here is there's this basically extensive side channel, and in high floods, the water comes up from a number of different directions, but it creates this side channel through here, and in particular, as the waters flow from everywhere, this is the main outlet it drains out of. And so that becomes kind of a critical area in how those floodwaters are managed. Also, one of my favorite points that we discovered as part of the historical process is the ferry. There used to be a ferry, and actually, when you're out on the side, you can almost see where the old riverbeds used to be. I love those direct relationships when you see something historical, you can actually tell on the site where that used to be. And it's kind of up in this little bit of an area here. So that was just kind of one of the cool things that are fun about being able to dive into some of these sites. We'll get back to details a little later. We also did some really late time looking at wetlands and flood boundaries, existing sites and conditions and connectivity. And so that really forms the basis of how we influence both what was already been envisioned for the site as well as what we find actually on the ground.
Another part of our assessment was to begin to understand what people were expecting out of the sites and asking some fairly direct questions of local community members. Now, we put together an on-site instrument. We also had a meeting with staff stakeholders to review some of the principles and features that the parks are likely to encompass in the future. We wanted to see what people had to say about them. Now, we've done a number of online questionnaires with communities over the years. And you never know what you're going to get in response. And we had several closed-ended questions where we're asking people to rate the appropriateness of various principles and various activity types or features on the park, and just let us know how appropriate people felt those things were from one facility to the next. And that was informative. I mean, that was good stuff. And we have graphical summary, and I believe that the draft survey results are included in the packet that went out. And I'm not really going to go into too much detail on these things, but what I will say is that overall, the impression that I had when looking at the survey results was one of amazement. Looking at the thoughtfulness that went into people's open-ended comments for each of the responses was just phenomenal. People really took some time, and we designed the survey instrument to be about a 5-minute completion. Someone could go through it in 5 minutes, so it wouldn't be too much of a hassle to do, but the average length that someone spent on the survey was 11 minutes. Now think about that. That's 11 minutes of someone's time that they took to actually go through not only answer the questions, but to deliver the comments. So we had about 250 or so responses, and we had hundreds of individual open-ended comments. And you'll see those in the packet. And the responses that we got really did help focus our energies when we got into that pop-up studio session. We had a sense of what might be, at least in general terms, a good fit for each facility. Mike and Juliet talked briefly about the pop studios. We were here all day Friday, all day Saturday, on the 15th and 16th of this month. We had two locations staffed with members of the consulting team, planners, landscape architects, and having conversations with community members. 150, I think that number might actually be a little bit low. We didn't have a counter out there. Next time you do one,
we need
a
counter. We were bombarded with people. It was awesome.
I think it's notable too, even over the last 4 years that I've been doing work in and around the row, just looking at the use patterns increase at Lake Tahoe. I mean, granted, it was a wonderful day. It was, school was just beginning, so maybe people have been doing the last, hurrah in for recreation. But still, Lake Tahoe was just brimming with activity. And we had people involved in the studio. We had 3-year-olds, 4-year-olds working with us. We had an octogenarian who just sold his veterinary practice in town to come and talk to us. I mean, we were all over the map with conversations that we had. And we had a three-pronged approach. We had a hook where we gave people a very short mini poll, which is derived from our online survey. And Julia will talk a little bit about the results of that, just to get people thinking about how we begin to position these parks to address community needs. And then when we got them with the hook, we were able to engage in a little bit more of a detailed Q&A, so we could quiz them about what it is that they wanted specifically out of the park and how we could shape it so it met their needs. And then the third activity is where we started to actually get them to give us direct comments, and then we were taking those down both on a flip chart and then also on a sketch map. And so we were actually building some of our alternative designs while we were talking with people. And we had a talent both at the park and in the Boys and Girls Club to be able to engage those conversations effectively at all three levels. We even had a cornhole at Lake Tahoe Park, so if people weren't necessarily interested in talking to us, they could at least play cornhole. So I guess we have two-foot engagement.
And candy.
We have the candy and some good park swag, which is always irresistible. So here's a slide of some of the comments that we got. I believe that you have copies of these also in your packet. So you can see that, and these are not only my hand or Juliet's hand and the hand of the other staff members. I mean, people got up there and gave them pens and their own good comments too, to make sure that we were understanding what it was that they were after.
And so the fun part about these types of events is not only these kind of crazy comments that people are asking, and I love it when they start going every which direction, because that just appeals to me as the designer. they're not all rigid, they're not all regular. But we also have to actually draw their comments and ideas, and it's not often we get to really sit down at a table with people and they're telling us what they want to see, and we can just draw it right then and there. And it really, I think two things stood out to me. There was one individual who came back and said, I don't do these very often, but this was just the most fun I've had. It's hard to get people to come to meetings, and so that, I think, really tells the success of the meetings, but also just how kind of passionate people were about these parts. So these are just examples. What we basically did, anyone who someone came up with, we would draw what they talked about, we'd show it on a plan, we'd talk about what that would look like. And then ultimately what we did is come up with concepts. And so the first day we were really developing what those concepts meant, what they could be, exploring wide ranges of ideas and opportunities. And then throughout the course of the day, you start to see patterns. Patterns of what people tell you. We were talking back and forth between the two sites, and I don't know, Skyping is my word, but it was something else, some fancy app that would let us talk to each other.
Skyping.
and so, I went into some detail what the concepts were, but And then what we do is we actually ask them to tell us, you know, so at the end of each day, we had an open house in the evening, and we ask people to come back and, okay, here's what you guys told us. What do you guys think now? What do you, you know, how would you rate this on a scale of 1 to 5? How much did this particular concept appeal to the visions and the ideas that you talked about? And so for the tie, we have one that was really about activating the edges. It was like, we love the tie, we love all the stuff we can do at Lake Tie, we just want to improve it, we want to make it better. And the other concept was really activate the water. Get people into the water any and every way we possibly can. And you can see it was a scale of 1 to 5. I mean, there are both really had lots of valid ideas in them. I think more people gravitated a little bit towards the activating the edges, just so that it really left that lake open for any variety of opportunities and didn't try to over-program the lake itself. So that was kind of the heart of the event space. Tide and Site, we had 3 alternatives that came up. There was a lot of different ideas. And so a lot of them related about how we interact with the water, both the pond on the site and its proximity to the river. So it was we called it reach the river, like, you know, literally directly get as, you know, onto that river as easily and as quickly as you can. We had circle the pond, which was really focused more inwardly on what you could do around the pond. And we had explore nature, which just said this is such a priceless kind of experience to be right next to an active park, to feel like you're really out in a natural environment, embrace that. And so then we asked them to rate this in the evenings and tell us what you thought. And they were, again, you know, really all fairly even. And so that tells me what we often do is we start to mix and match. We start to blend lots of different concepts and ideas. And that's the point where we're at right now. I think the reach the river was a little bit higher rated just because it really did speak to the desire to get on the river, which we've heard through a lot of different processes. So then this is that hook, that little pole we gave them, the hook. And what we're trying to do here was ultimately we have to start to prioritize the different ideas that we have in order to develop a preferred concept. So what we're trying to do here is give them, you know, from all this time, a very activity, you know, active-oriented and events to passive recreation, like right on this scale where you think the preferred concept should land. Where do you feel is the right balance between those two activities? Between water improvements and land improvements, where is that right balance? And so we've got some average scores and things that you can show. What you really start to see is that a lot of them work a little bit more in the middle. So Lake Tye was really fairly even between active and events and passive recreation. It's a little heavier on the passive recreation, but I think that's what people felt were lacking in the experience now. And then water versus land was kind of even when you look between it. What I heard a lot in the open house was don't limit our ability to get on and use the water, enhance it, but make the experience going around the lake much better as well. So for the cabin site, active versus natural focus, water access versus landward focus, and again, you see kind of a lot of in the middle that both were pretty equally important. And then we asked a little bit about funding between partnerships or local funding as well, and you see really strongly right in the middle we want both.
Great, thanks, Julia. That's a great summary. Yeah. You know, the alternatives that we showed really were focused on development of these individual sites. And I think there's a tendency to focus within just the boundaries of those individual pieces of land when you're looking at the master plan. But really, the communication you're having with people, I'm not only were they looking at the opportunities for development of that particular site, they're also looking beyond the edge of the site and trying to find ways that we can make the edges of the sites as permeable as possible. It's easy to get into Lake Tye Park, and if you're at Sky River Park, then really there is no perceptible boundary between where you are in Sky River Park and how you get into Cabin. Different experiences, but still have a permeable edge so that people can access the park from as many directions as possible. So this one, I just wanted to state that. Okay, so based on the conversations we had during the pop-ups and our interpretations of the mini poll results and what we heard from that hook mini poll exercise at the pop-ups, we came up with revised visions. And if you look at the table in front of you, you'll see not only do you have an agenda page, but you also have a worksheet. Now, I'll introduce this now. We're not necessarily going to work through this unless you'd like to do it, but I wanted to have this to you as an instrument to give us feedback
And that's something you can work on tonight during the course of the conversation, or if you want to take a moment to work on it, you can do that, give it back to Mike. So what it is that it's a revised vision statement, and we're asking you for guidance on, do you like it, which would be the thumbs up, are you unsure, which would be the question mark, or have you totally missed the boat, which would be the, well, you know, don't do it. So don't know what that's called. Circle with a hash, I guess. Or a slash. And there's also room there where you can make some comments on how you think you might want to adjust it so that it's a better fit. But if you compare this to what we started out with, you'll see that this vision still, while it's at a high level, is really much more refined and direction setting than what we had going in. There's more nuance here that I think gives us a good springboard for design work ahead. Also, Juliet put together a word cloud, and this is based on the mini poll response.
So it's based on the actual principal statement. So all of the words that are used in those principal statements between Cadman site and the Lake Tai site, you can see what, you know, if you just looked at those principles in front of you, what words start to come to the highlight.
When we're working with trying to collect the thinking, we found that it would be helpful for us to divide our ideas among those that are relevant at a principle level. You know, what are these things that are going to be guiding our hands from a larger perspective versus the individual features that will begin to typify apart. I mean, somebody might want to splash, that's a great idea for a feature, but it doesn't necessarily get to the principle. Where the principle is activating kids outdoors in water, not necessarily tapping the swim. Okay, so you can kind of see that distinction. So when you look at the following pages in the handout, you'll see that we have a statement of principles for Lake Tai and features for Lake Tai. And then the same for CAD. Principles for Lake Tai, feet tie, principles regarding the features for Lake Tai. And we'll begin to see how we're interpreting this and really, in essence, beginning to formulate a planning program. So after breezing through this, you'll see that we're establishing what we believe is a sense of direction. And that is going to be the key of our work tonight, is to make sure that we're tracking okay. We wanted to give you an instrument that you could use as a reference point as we have our conversation. So that's what that is all about. Ever since I found out that I was only 4 credits short of a statistics minor, I've looked at that finding ways to graph stuff like this. And so this is something of an abstraction here that I think will explain our alternatives generation and our direction setting task now. We receive hundreds of comments and thoughts about park features and principles that range from being passive to active, that range from being natural to more developed, and that might have a variety of cost implications. And so this is just an example of how we might think about those in chart form. Then our next job is to develop these types of scenarios that would fall within that dot pattern. So we're beginning to address those ideas about relative levels of activity and investment in the park, consistent with the character. But our job now is to come up with something that will probably be something of a hybrid of the different alternatives so that we can really create a best fit for the community's array of expectations.
Okay, that's a lot of background context on the process. What we want to do now is walk through where we think we're going. They are very sketchy concepts. I think you got what we had, a nice big draft across the front of them when you had your package. Are there any questions before we do that on the process or what we heard and the pop-ups and the information we've gathered?
Good. On the wetlands at Cadman, you say that that's kind of flexible. I mean, they change. Is that something that happens rapidly? I mean, I'm wondering how much those changes affect what we're forward planning.
They don't happen very rapidly. The floods come and go. It doesn't necessarily create a lot of new wetlands overnight with those flood waters. You might get localized ponding, but it eventually seeps in. It's not going to necessarily be a wetland. The interesting thing here is when you're doing large-scale planning, you start with a lot of data already based on USGS and different kinds of reports at a very, very high level. And so when we first got the plans, and even some of the early cabinets site work from the operations that's currently ongoing to have some of that preliminary wetland data. When you actually get this, it's kind of highlights the importance of putting feet on the ground. Turns out we have less wetlands than they thought. So we actually gain a fair amount of space by actually validating what the data shows with what you can actually see on the ground. Now, the reason I say it still fluctuates is ultimately when you get to building a project, we will have to go back out there and really nail down exactly where that wetland boundary is. And it still may shift a little. It's not going to shift, it's not going to shift hundreds of feet. It's not likely even, you know, but 20 feet here and there, totally possible as you actually not only stake it in the field, but then have an official survey group come back and confirm the full limit of it. So they're really rough outlines and kind of blobby gestures for a reason, because we are just not exact until you get to that higher level of detail. Any other questions? Do you see another hand raised? Okay.
Catherine first?
Yes, Catherine first. Okay, so what I want to do is I want to walk through what the concepts actually are. And this is leading towards what we heard as a consolidated preferences. So we're trying to lead towards a preferred concept and a preferred alternative. Orientation, and I realize some of this, it's actually easier to see the screen or to see the hard copy for you guys. About the same?
Yes.
Okay. Yes to both. All right, so Sky River Park sits here. Boys and Girls Club is kind of at the top. These plans all start to show existing parking lots in Sky River Park. And in all the cases for Cadman, there's an existing access to the Cadman site that is currently just blocked off with large concrete, and that occurs right here. Universally based on topography, natural systems, drainage, I mean, that totally makes the most sense to continue to use as the access point. Yes?
Where's the bus barn?
Where's the bus barn? Up to the north?
So Main Street is where?
Main Street is up here, right at the very edge.
So access it down through next to the prison and the storage?
Vehicle access will basically follow the same as what we currently do to get into Sky River Park. You go past that first gravel parking lot and you would turn off right off the end of that gravel parking lot into the Cadman site.
Okay.
Now that is the vehicle access point. That would also, I expect, to be the main pedestrian access point. But what came out of the public meeting was to try and really connect beyond that one entrance point and connect out a little bit further. In particular, the area you're talking about off of what is 177th and turns into
Reformatory
Road is. That is also the location of the Centennial Trail that comes past Lake Tide and kind of turns and heads into Main Street. So one of the bigger connectivity concepts was to try and actually bring that Centennial Trail potentially into the site and through the site a little bit more, rather than giving more of an off-street opportunity for that experience. So there is examples here of connecting beyond that are not necessarily fully developed yet.
This is Davidson's Farm.
I'm sorry?
Davidson's Farm.
Davidson's Farm. I think, is that the one that is, sits over here a little bit towards the end of Reformatory Road? Yeah. So if you go down Reformatory Road, wetland banking site, I think, or there's something that kind of sits right on this very corner here. You keep going and you go past the farm. And I forget exactly what it is at the end of the road when we were driving out there.
It's there.
Yeah, but it's off on this side.
Thank you.
Okay, so some of the main concepts we've heard. So this area here in the middle is the pond that's existing. This is what we're calling the private property. This, within this boundary, is the Cadman site that's going to continue to remain in operation. They will access off of 177th and Reformatory Road. So that's the road that all of the trucks in and out of their site will continue to use. Right now, if you go out there, you'll see a large berm that they've recently, I think they're done building it by now, but they might be finishing this end of it. That large berm will eventually get planted. There will likely be a fence somewhere within this property line, and then that will help form the boundary of what's the public park versus the private Cadman site that will remain. The pond is essentially as it currently
again. They do still have restoration efforts to do on the site. Little fuzzy exactly what that's going to be because we are waiting for this master plan process to go through its completion and then start to meld what we want to see on the site with how they might ultimately restore the site. But they do have to fully restore it so that there's not a lot of bare ground or other things, more erosion control and more planting on the site. The goal of the timing of this process is so, for example, if we have a parking lot, we don't necessarily want to put a forest of trees there so that we can coordinate some of those efforts in the future. Alright, so what we're basically showing here is there's a lot of discussion to actually try and get directly to the river. And so a lot of our concepts and discussions talked about how far do we want and are we willing to bring vehicles into this site? And how difficult or how easy do we want it to be to actually get canoes and kayaks directly into the river? And so we showed a lot of different alternatives during that pop-up. Where it really landed was we want to be able to experience the more natural environment of the Kathmandu site itself. Yes, we want to experience the river, but it's not the first and foremost isn't all about just getting to the river, because that is a fairly narrow still group of people. So what we basically looked at is creating and using the pond itself. And so we have an access drive, we have a parking lot in here. It's about the same size as what the gravel parking in Sky River is, kind of for reference of scale. It's tucked into the disturbed area and outside all the wetlands and their buffers. And then we have a boat launch, a hand-carried boat launch that would actually tie into both the pond itself, but also there's opportunities to really tie into this more natural system of the wetlands back in the back. Now it's more seasonal going this way, where the pond is more year-round. But there are some great opportunities for education and wildlife enhancement and ecology to be able to experience these kind of backwater areas.
Correct. Yes. I heard you say, okay, what you just said was you'd probably take your kayak and get on the pond, and then you said where you can experience the wetlands. Or you're talking about trails in the wetlands, not kayaks.
I'm talking about both. With improvements to the habitat of this side channel system, you could actually seasonally get your kayak and be able to experience it from the water side, definitely from the trail side. What we were looking at doing was actually, some of the interesting things came out of the open house was that you wanted, once you're in the pond, it's nice to feel like you're really truly immersed in a more natural environment, even though, yes, it's man-made. So sculpting the pond, maybe even some islands in the pond, give it something that really feels like it's an experience in and of itself. The upland area itself allows some opportunity for a restroom, for a small concession. You can rent your tube, you can rent a kayak or canoe, and ultimately, there is a connection from the pond to the river, but it would be a portage connection. So if you really wanted to, you could park here, you could piddle around the lake with your kids, you could send somebody else, your teenagers or whoever else, off to portage and go up and down the river while everybody else just stays at the pond itself. Lots of opportunities for more. This is a fairly traditional playground. We heard ideas with more natural plays, with running, climbing, different kinds of play that you don't have elsewhere in the city right now. But this is an opportunity to do something that fits into that natural environment. And then really lots of trails all the way throughout. What this concept does to get people directly into the river is it actually pulls off of the dock park parking is a fairly reasonable connection to use that as a direct access to go in as a hand-carry launch into the river. So your motorized boat would stay the same. You have a direct access and separated for kayaks and canoes, and then you would have the ability to fiddle around the pond as well as get directly into the river if you wanted to from there. Lots of trails. There is some open space here. This is that area that I talked about that we thought was going to be wetlands that is not. So that gives us some opportunity to do some different kinds of interpretive trails, different kinds of systems, different kinds of natural environments that we can experience. And it also gives us the opportunity, what I'm calling an alternative site, is tent camping and RV parking. So one of the things we've heard was there's a lot of events and there's no place for all these RVs and tents and camping. A lot of discussion, should this be individual, should it be group, is it, how is it managed, how is it maintained, lots of different potential ideas of how that could work. This is a big area we are looking for you guys to help give us some direction on. Pros that we've heard, There's a lot of events. Having a place for people to actually be for the weekend during the events could also be revenue generating, but also alleviate some of the demands of parking at that river if those events occur. Also interesting came up, what if the Boys and Girls Club ran a camp during the summer? What if there's a large group that wants to rent the whole thing, that it didn't have to be a daily basis and individual rentals? It could be managed a number of different ways. It does fit, which was kind of our big goal at this stage. Does it fit? Can you get vehicles in and out? Is it even reasonable to assume? And it does actually fit about 30 stalls if you truly maximize it. Of course, you don't have to do the whole thing. It is a surprisingly larger area, and somewhere around 30 to 50 kinds of tents if you really kind of, depending on how much you wanted to pack them in or how much you wanted some extra space around it. But it does give you enough flexibility. I think what I want to do is quickly get through the tie sites, and then we can kind of come back with any other questions and some different comments and feedback. Okay, like Ty, we're flipping orientation on you because we just can't turn the whole TV, so we've got to match it in this case. North is up. I guess north is that way. Okay, yeah, towards Bill. Here is the existing school.
Do you want to do south side first?
Yeah, I'm just going to orient. Yeah, actually, let's go ahead and do south side first. So we have the existing school and the existing fields here. The first set of fields are what's kind of co-managed with the school district. So there's kind of a fence around it so they can have access during the school hours. Here's your ball field that's there now, and this is the shelter. It's kind of a little dot where you can see that you hold the stage and have the events in the outfield of the ball field. Parking kind of follows along this line through here, main entrance, secondary entrance for the school. The skate park is kind of more white spot here in the end. And then, of course, the rest of the lake that we all know. So we want to get kind of quickly into, all right, we'll just go, we'll do the south end first. So some of the things we heard was more about activating the edges and improving the edges and dividing uses in programs. So right now, we go out there.
Actually, we can do this. We could put the north end.
Oh, yeah. Now that's multitasking. So, about the diversifying programs and diversifying uses. So, if you go out there now, you have a bunch of fishermen, you know, they're casting, their hooks are kind of everywhere, you really want your little kids kind of digging through the sand. There's a lot of concerns about that. There was also a surprising perception about water quality, that while, you know, we understand that the lake is great, it works just fine, there's not a water quality issue, there's a lot of concerns about it. I think it's more the perception of how it looks than anything actually in the water itself. Really improving that swimming beach area, starting to separate uses, bringing an actual dock out and ADA accessibility for the boat launch that's there now, bringing in more universal accessibility into the beach and the swimming areas, and starting to really define these more pods along the lake. So those different pods could be like a little fishing mode. It could be kind of a more natural way just to kind of get down and hang your feet in the water, or it could be really a little habitat mode where we get additional vegetation, we get some more overhang, we create better habitat all along the lake. Getting the trail all the way along the lake, there are two main areas that the community really felt needed improvement. This is one, so that you're not necessarily forced all the way out and have to find your way back in, but to be able to come down the hillside and cut across in a boardwalk system and have a more direct connection, so you're truly circling the lake and not having to go through a lot of other different uses. Well, probably one of the biggest new features that came up was this idea of something spray. Like, everybody loves the spray ground, universally. Everybody loves the spray ground. And they love being able to go to the beach, but having some kind of a water feature when you don't really want your kids to get in the water, but still want to be able to cool off and have some fun. So that's the idea of more of a spray, not a full spray park, but more of a fountain deck coming up, something that could be very visual and kind of celebrate the park in and of itself, but also be playful for people to be actually engaged in. And so we had a couple of different ideas of how to do that from a more formal system to something that maybe uses stormwater and kind of weaves its way through the open space of the park itself. A lot of what you see here is about optimizing it for the uses that you have. So we're not trying to suddenly turn the courts into football. We're not trying to, like, you know, create a whole lot of new activities on what's already a heavily programmed space. But making sure we have ideas for how we can improve parking, how we can improve access access to and run those spaces so you can get the stage in and out without tearing up the lawn every time it turns around, how you get the maintenance vehicles effectively up to the area that they need to maintain the lake. A lot of more interventions throughout the park to just make it function better for what you already use it for. The other big area is when we go to the north side. So the north side was, right now, as you go around the lake, you're kind of shot straight out back onto Fire Boulevard. And then you get there and you know you got to turn, but it's just not the most comfortable. If you're not used to it, you're not entirely sure where you're going or where you're trying to get back to. So a lot of the comments were on the north end of the lake. How do we bring a boardwalk system, bring a bridge, better connect this side so you don't have to go out onto Fireland Boulevard? And then really make this little peninsula into something to celebrate. So it's not kind of just, is there because the pole has to be there? Make it into something, you know, really bring in some little floating islands right in the outfall. It helps the habitat, it helps the water quality, it can have a lot of educational value, and kind of create something more of an interest there. You get all the way around, bringing more of the fishing, you know, kind of fishing nodes, more natural nodes. Those kinds of things would continue throughout the rest of the rest of the trail. And then the future trailhead, kind of this idea of how do we really bring people in when the Centennial Trail does come through? How can we actually use that to our advantage? Is it a trailhead? Is it just for bikers? Is it a stopping station? But really doing something in that corner to draw people down into the park. Okay, this is one of the major elements.
No, I think you did a great job. You know, just kind of going back to that mini-roll exercise that we had at the studio, and one of the reasons why I think we saw some ambivalence between active and passive at Lake Tahoe, so the site truly is both. You know, and it zones, you know, pretty discreetly, right? I mean, this is the active realm, and you know if you've experienced it, as soon as you turn this corner, it's a different world. And so I think that was something that came up loud and clear in the conversations. And then also the sense of potentially a missed opportunity here. You know, you've got a nice commercial development, you've got a school, but it doesn't really take advantage of that waterfront opportunity. So how can we learn from that and really make this an experience that you're going to be proud of and enjoy as a user, and maybe even use it as an opportunity to stimulate some level of commercial development in these areas when they decide to move.
I have one question. Did anyone in any of the open houses talk about the gravel trail that's on the other side of the lake? Because I know I run there all the time. Sometimes it's been marked no trespassing. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, so it is private once you get to that gravel edge. So we have enhanced landscape screening along the west side of the park.
Okay.
Anyway. it is an ongoing concern, and what happens right now is, you can't see it too much in the background, but there's an existing path that comes right here. The end of that path is conveniently that little foot traffic that everyone cuts through to get on the gravel instead. So a couple of things we can do. How we modify circulation so that you're really guiding people where you want them to go. And also just what you do with trails, I know, you create a little gravel shoulder that's a couple of feet wide so someone who doesn't want to be hitting the pavement has a gravel edge to do. It's not going to solve every problem. A lot of it's dogs and a lot of dog walking on that edge. But there are things we can do to reinforce the boundary, direct people where we want them to go, and give them that varied experience on the trail.
In your conversations and questions to people, what was their concern about the eyesore, the old Panalaska building that and how to make
it? Give me the man. Yeah, well, a lot of people make comments just like that. You know, what can happen? And it is impacted by the airport. You know, so there are some limitations on its ultimate development profile. But yeah. You know, it would be great to see something happen on that site and the site around it when one of the times right for it to redevelop.
I noticed they just put a fence around it.
I haven't noticed that. It must be relatively new in the last couple of weeks. Lots of ideas about what you could do with it if it was ever to become part of the park. So, you know, a true trailhead for the Centennial Trail to environmental, to open space, to all kinds of stuff. But I think also recognizing that while there's opportunities, you know, it's not something you can necessarily plan on now. Yes.
but the trail all the way around the lake. I was there tonight walking, and that's missing, you know, because you have Swan Silence, and it's a missed opportunity not to have that completely around the lake, so I'm glad that that came out in the conversation. And I agree 100% around, you know, the view bridges and the northern part of the lake, and, you know, a lot of people walk around there, but there's missed opportunity to use that a little bit more in the commercial development there. My one question is there might be, because it's a shoreline, limits on kind of what we can do in commercially to kind of access. So have you guys discussed, you know, development along the lake? How do we proceed with that?
So let me start with a little bit about just the limitations.
Yeah.
So one of our, you know, these are still kind of broad concepts.
Right.
A lot of our next steps is to drill down a little bit more so we understand how do we now actually accomplish it, and what are some of the grading and drainage and other types of limitations that might affect what it looks like. It's important to us not to try and just nail down what the design is, but more importantly, so we can nail down what the cost is and how we might potentially fund and implement things. So we will start to get into that level of detail. In particular here, we're really seeing how a lot of folks to deal with, so we have to think about how much can we really, you know, ideally we would want to be able to connect and interconnect with this, and I think ultimately we might show some arrows and talk about opportunities for more connectivity, public-private type partnership stuff, but we also have to recognize there's a big scope to get to. So we also are always thinking about, if we do something, how do we make it accessible? And then if we can't, you know, what do we do about that as well? So potentially there's certainly some opportunities.
And one last question, is there any discussion around a dock? I guess you have a little one going out.
We have a little one going here. We have a number of comments. Do we bring the dock all the way across from the south end? Do we kind of define an edge? Do we cut across in more places in the middle? Certainly possibly. I think, you know, again, at this level, we're like, yep, we want a dock. We want to think of ways to get people out. This little idea here is actually like a platform that might extend out, so something that's accessible access to the water, but also feels like a dock without having to get it in front of it that you might affect the activities on the lake. And then I talked about these kinds of little nodes. There might be other opportunities around the edge to actually bring people out into the lake.
Do you have a comment?
Yeah, I have a couple questions. So the line, they look like walkways with little lines. Is that supposed to be docks all the way around?
Wetlands. So they would be like boardwalks or docks, depending on whether it's ground underneath, really squishy ground, or completely water.
Okay. So I love that idea of tying that around, and the view bridge, and taking advantage of that. Over on this side, you have up at the top, you have two arrows pointing up towards Friends. What do those signify?
Crosswalks and connectivity. So right now there's an existing trail here, and how do we actually get across and bring people better in? It's the other part of connectivity that really felt was missing when we were out there, is you get to the end of this, and you're kind of just, again, you're just sort of hit with a dead end of the boulevard. So looking from our traffic, so the other part of our team, when we were civil and engineering, so looking from traffic and drainage and all those sorts of things, we start to overlay those different types of influences on the design. Probably not the best place to try and do a mid-block with all the curves, so what can we do to kind of redirect people on either side? The other thing we heard was this area in general is where the viewing is when there are major events on the water. So taking an opportunity for that, which will give us a visual clue when you get here, that's your quickest way over. Or if you're trying to get to the sports fields, you're going this way. So it gives people opportunities, and doing something fairly significant here has a double duty of improving the viewing and accessibility while also being that visual identifier of the better way into the park.
Yeah, I really like that. and the theater and connecting them to the businesses right there. That's really great.
Yeah, we heard during our pop-up studios that there are times when fireworks closes, when we have the wakeboard events here, and perhaps even triathlons. More and more of that kind of community activity seems to be on the horizon. And so we were trying to find ways that we could encourage flexible use of fireworks blue water for that type of thing. Not quite a festival street concept, but still try to make that a permeable edge to the park as much as possible. And then also rewarding people who cross here with some kind of a feature, river water feature, to give them that kind of immediate access to the water surface.
So I know, was it directly related to this? There was a couple of,
yes.
Okay, so we'll do this and then we'll come back to you guys.
It's more of a comment. I wanted to make sure that when you're using the word accessibility, that you're using the widest sense,
yes,
including the people with disabilities.
Yes.
One of the features that I've seen that I think would be interesting to add to the beach swimming area is actually like a wheelchair accessible ramp all the way into the water.
I love that you said that. Right there. So both getting wheelchair accessibility into the water as well as a dock kind of a system here allows people who really aren't comfortable getting into the water to still feel like they're on the water. The textural differences are also very helpful for universal accessibility.
Yeah, and making sure that the ramp is wide enough that if a person is using a wheelchair, that if there's room for people to go and still pass.
Okay. And then you guys have a couple questions? Pass it off the line, Michael.
First, North End of the Lake, I like the extension for the peninsula and Gamble Bridging. I think it's something that we need to do for a long time. And of course, going all the way around it, the lake gets close to water, is always a cluster. Inlets to the lake. So you've got one at the south end, you've got one at the north end, and there you go. Okay. There are going to be a significant natural feature to help develop or help improve all over the lake. I don't see any reference to it in the maps unless it's really, really small and I can't see it.
Yeah, that's an interesting observation. I think that's something that would need to look into it. Well, we were talking about it, but we were a little bit puzzled on what to do with those things.
We've had long discussions of bioswales and actually having natural filtration systems, which is, I think, we're getting next year officially. That will be a natural environmental feature, which can go towards whatever wildlife demonstration. I'm thinking taking a class out there with the wildlife birds or whatever.
Yes, the school right next door. So the couple, so let me know who on the right track of what we've been thinking about for that. I think there's probably more we should talk about in this area, so that's a good comment to really rethink this one. In this area, actually creating some habitat islands to do that. And then also, this seems like an opportunity that is not less known right now, where it is another inlet, to literally create like a hole in the boardwalk to see where the water, it's actually kind of cool if you improve it, where water truly comes right down into that lake.
Right.
So bringing it to the surface while you're educating about it, too.
And you can show. And that would be good. I think that would be
good.
Good. That's good. Thank
you. Yes.
My background comes from the school district, okay? So what I just heard is a paradigm change that when we built that school, we did not want, or the city did not want, or the city and the school together did not want sidewalks along Front Island Boulevard. They wanted to channel people down 154th across the street and into the school, but they wanted to channel them down Wales and across the street at the park to come into that area. They did not want a sidewalk on that side of Front Island Boulevard.
Yeah, the side.
Now you're talking about doing that. Has there been some thought process to if that's still a good thing, or is it just a thought process change? I'm not against it, don't get me wrong.
Are you talking about the west side of Front Island Boulevard or the east side?
The east side. So that sidewalk between Wales and there's one other entrance into the park. park and on the 154th. There was distinctly the desire at that time not to have that be sidewalk because they didn't want kids walking on Firelands Boulevard. They wanted to channel out the other street across the street with the signals to the walking area to the school. So I don't know where you're at with that, but it deserves a thought process before it goes too far.
I think that's it.
I think this is staying true to that intent, but with the one exception of the crosswalk being added right across from right there. That's the only area that you're crossing. I don't think there's any added sidewalk on the Dylan side, east side of Barry Stall. I just want to go on the walk. We want to channel down to here and across.
Yeah. I think we've got some extra lines showing here. You can actually start to see two lines. They're actually both on the
park side.
Park side.
You'd be a bad interpretation of
them. Yeah.
So maybe interjectively quickly, Fred Majagger is 10 feet, and we had about an hour for the succession groups over an hour right now. I want to make certain we also touch on cabinet. I also want to make certain there's the thoughts they have on this. So just letting everybody know that's kind of where we are right now. And so let's go ahead and finish up the time when we move back to cabinet. And I think the Councilmember Rasmussen was on.
I'm only going to speak to the school district side because I'm involved now. I can't speak to the what it looked like when they made the decisions in 2005 related to new Frylands, but I can tell you this. The growth from there to now is much higher. Our bus transport that we have that doesn't account for Frylands at all. So it is all basically bring your kid or walk. So, I don't know what it was like before, but I can say this. If we're increasing traffic to the school via pedestrian, I would think sidewalks would probably not be a problem of future expansion, if that's what it came to. Not that it's on there, but just okay. Just check that.
And then I think there was one more question on here, and then we can hopefully go to the private side.
Yeah. My personal opinion on the sidewalks, I think, are needed on that side. So, and as I said, that's what the plans are there. But my main question was on the view bridge. Does that, in the concept, arch enough so that someone in a kayak or a canoe can roll underneath it?
At least arched enough for the kayak and the canoe to go underneath it. I'm less certain on how much, when there is a major boating event, like the wakeboarding, yeah. I've heard with someone that they need to turn around or not, but that would be kind of the detail we have to figure out. And then also, how do we do that and still make it accessible? So there's kind of a balance there. So, yeah.
This seems to be a pretty popular fishing zone.
Yeah, no problem.
I got some of the best fishing holes in the row. It's been kind of cool.
Just a couple of quick questions that I have. The trail that is ringing around next to the lake, I like that also. Is that anticipated to be hard surface or soft surface?
So I think it's important to have a hard surface that circumvents all the way around the lake, and so between a boardwalk or a paved surface, it would be accessible and hard. I think what we were thinking for the soft surface is where we can actually do a secondary kind of adjacent soft surface shoulder. You don't really have the width to do like totally two separate trails.
Okay, and to Danny's point, those of us that like to run, and there are other people that just like to walk on it. It's nice having a brush rock there to run along. The other thing too that I like about the plans that I'm seeing, in addition to the other comments that I've heard, is I do like the landscaping. Running along those straight asphalt stretches where you're facing into the sun one direction and then facing going the other direction with the sun hitting on the other side. I think having some tree canopy out there will be good. It will provide at least the feeling of a windbreak during certain times of the year, but it will provide shade during other times of the year. So I kind of like seeing some of the trees that are in there. My interest would be to make certain we can still see view into the lake. So if you're doing evergreens, having those live up over time, but deciduous would be really good if our sort of your native lollipop-ish trees, inventing words here. That's all right. Thank you.
That's for heart.
Somebody came up also about the late tide conversation. I'm glad you brought those up.
Mr. Mayor,
is this diversification of the shoreline edge? Because right now it's almost a monoculture on the side. You know, so maybe there are opportunities. If we want to encourage people to kayak and canoe and stand up paddleboard out here, let's give them an edge experience that is really interesting for them.
Okay, time to say.
I like the portage access. I'm not so sure if you're talking about kayaks, how much you're going to go up the river at certain times of the year.
Yeah.
I can see possibly like at Lewis, the boat launch, or up further and then going down, although that's a pretty short run. But I can see tubing or something like that. Ideally, it would be nice to see even longer runs somewhere further down, having a takeout or something.
I've got two comments quickly in response to that. That kind of conversation came up in the studio too, and some people were interested in putting in a tube, coming down here, taking out, and doing laps with the family. So I probably make it 2 laps. The kids would make it 10, but you know, still having that opportunity. But also taking advantage of what might happen upstream towards Sultan for river access, and maybe on the south side of the river, so we have an opportunity to link this with the river trail experience, and then. We were also taking the perspective of this is phase one, and maybe this is phase two. And so we start looking at where the park might expand in who knows how many years if Kevin decides to relocate, then that gives us another opportunity to reconsider another access point that's really downstream from just this one.
The second part of my question had to do with seeing the kayak launch. Show me on this map where your idea for the RV parks were.
So vehicles come in and go here. You could come into the water here, so this is our kayaks, or here for our kayaks.
Nice kayak.
Okay, so RV. This is a large open space, and this is a forested space that's outside our wetland. If we were going to do RV, we'd probably come off the end of this, relocate some of this, you know, a little bit elsewhere, and then RV would be in like, and it's kind of like open lawn, you pull in, you've got, you know, a handful of them have hookups closer to the road, a few of them probably don't. It's got to be dual purpose so that when there's nobody here, it's a bunch of them in open space.
So my question is, are your RV spaces like RV, a lot with RVs parked next to one another? Or are you talking about the forested area where you can actually have a lot that has an RV, you've got some borders between, so it's a true camping experience, and then another
RV? Like, yes. I think any either or something in between. That's really where we want to hear what should that experience look like. I think the greater steps you could get an RV back into the forested tent camping if you wanted to create it. We have designed some of those camping grounds before, so it would definitely work. What I understand from events is they really need a lot of them. They just want to park their RV, have easy access, and they're not quite here. But they're going to experience the woods, they're going somewhere else. So it can be pretty flexible, I think. To me, it's important that it is at least the open space is usable when there's no RVs there. It looks and feels like something you want to, you know, throw frisbee on and not be worried about what's sticking up out of the ground to run into.
And you also want to have your lake experience be, rewarding lake experience.
I will say just before we leave that there was equally concerns on if you do it, how do you manage it so it doesn't become a transient concern, a long-term transient concern. So that is probably one of the biggest downsides that I heard. There was a comment here and then over to Washington.
Thank you. And yeah, that is one of the concerns I heard a lot. We don't have trains in town. This actually applies, these comments apply mostly to Al Borland, but I can see where it would hit here. I've been talking to some people about RV parks, whether or not we'd be able to have RVs down there, and generally people who own RVs are saying no, it would really be much more than a KOA version or a city KOA version or something. But I did hear a lot about urban camping, especially as applied to Alboro, where you have like selected sites where you could backpack in and go camping and do your fishing thing, and you can do the same thing here. In the meantime, someone who's not interested in fishing or is just doing the whole experience is close enough to the city so they could go out to downtown, do shopping, or whatever other event they want to do. So I don't really see RV parking down there as a real positive unless it's really... I just can't see it. But some kind of urban campground, I think, would be a better thing.
If you look at the survey responses, you'll see that I think many people share their opinion.
Okay.
But there's a lot of ambivalence around whether we even introduce RVs in any way.
Right. One of the points, I was talking to people who were coming up here from out of town to go fishing in the river because, you know, I guess we've got a good fishing river. And that was one of their things. They could drive up here for a day and do the fishing thing, but if they could spend a weekend up here, do the fishing and have other entertainment options, and again, they do the campground thing, but they could also do the city thing if they wanted to.
Would be a real plus.
And this would be the exact same thing. If you walk out and do the city.
So just to keep us moving along, yeah. There was a comment in the back and then in
the front. Well, I was just curious what, just in general, the feedback was from that you guys received on RV parking. Seems kind of split is what I'm hearing, or?
I think if I were to sum it up for most of what I heard, not opposed to it, predominantly related to major events in Sky River Park. So if someone wanted to come park their RV for a weekend because they're having a major tournament, this might be a great opportunity to do that, but less desire for it year-round. I probably heard more interest in the idea of group camping, urban camping, the YMCA comes and holds a summer camp out here for 2 weeks. Those kinds of things.
Bike packers, that's something
we've seen.
Yeah. But also, the RV conversation made us look at, okay, maybe there's demand for it, but if we have an opportunity for an outdoor experience here, maybe we can convert some of this overflow parking into something that can be
sold. And then right here first, and then over to the side.
Do
you still have a
comment? Yeah. No, I love the RV parking. We have a lodging issue in the city, period. So an opportunity to actually help with that with the amount of events that we have in town. As an avid fisherman and hunter, I ain't going out in a tent. But I know a lot of folks that tow their, you know, boats and launch right there that, yeah, I might have my camper and have a spot that I could, go back to and, you know, be right there in a nice spot. That would be great. The amount of events that we go with the Sky River Park, and then actually this would flow over into Lake Tye. It's a connection to Lake Tye. A lot, and not just Lake Tye, but also the neighboring soccer field. And we'll have hundreds, if not thousands, of people that will show up, but we don't have places for them to go. It's a revenue, potential revenue generation, thing for the city if you do it right. Being an avid sports person too, and traveling teams and all that kind of stuff, that's what they do. A good portion of the teams will pick a tournament based on the availability of RV accessibility and camping.
Okay, a couple questions over here before we come back to the site.
So to what extent is your RV vision? Are we talking about full-on utility hookups, or are we talking minimal? Because my concern about doing this is, like, it's great for revenue, but the expenses associated with it, not just from the city, but also the demand on the parks.
I think some of that would be our next phase. I'm hearing that there's certainly, I haven't heard anyone say absolutely, God knows we don't want any tent or RV parking. So I'm hearing that in general it's something worth pursuing. I think our job is then to say, okay, what would it take minimally to do it, and how much, and is it even feasible to bring in utilities and make it true RV? And then that next phase of preferred options, we will have some of those answers.
And this is one reason, I'll use yours as an example, this is one reason why we have to divide it into principles and features, because we start looking at ERV as a feature, but does it fit within the overall principle framework that you want this department to achieve? So it might help answer some of that question for you. And we do want to make sure that you work on these and let us know.
We're giving you homework. I actually think the airport would be a really good RV site. What about flooding? I mean, I've been at Dunkirk where the whole bottom parking lot is completely flooded. It's like a river coming through there. So how often does this whole site flood? And the improvements that we make, I mean, it would seem like you'd have to make them that would withstand that and then not take too much, you know, money or funding to repair every year, maybe.
So it's a twofold approach. One is understanding where the flood waters go in and out, and trying to collect that data to understand it better. As we're looking at improvements that actually improve flood capacity or make the flood recession work quicker, easier, and faster.
Okay.
Those are kind of the two main goals. So doing some of the improvements up here for habitat, it's great for habitat. We can get a bunch of habitat grants to do it. There's also improves the ability for all that water to actually have an outlet out. Comes in very quickly, recedes very slowly, so the faster we can get it out. And then, like you said, just building and knowing that things are going to flood, bridges, boardwalks, things like that, and build them, understanding how the flood water is going to interact with them and make them either temporarily unbreakable, right, and just replace them, or truly allow those waters to come in and recede.
Okay. That's just my concern, and as we look at this and plan for this, that we always have that in mind. And
the biggest implication at this stage in the process, I think, really relates to the budget. So we have to put enough money in there to allow the flexibility of how you treat it during a flood. We don't want to assume we're going to do everything temporary and you're going to have to maintain it, because then we don't have enough budget to truly build it to last. We tend to budget to build it to last. You got lots of opportunities to make it, you know, to find the balance in that life cycle analysis.
I think I've got another hand.
Just very, very quickly, on the RV park, I know our discussions, as I recall, on the park board, the primary focus was events. It was less about making this a camping destination or even the sportsman's destination. It was for the soccer events, the tournaments, things like that. So it was really much more short-term, much more defined,
walk for line.
Exactly.
Or opening day pushing season.
I was gonna say, just gonna leave the sportsmen's out.
They're not. I've learned there's a high season and a prime spot.
Oh, you
know, when they start running.
That's a single event.
Yeah, but it's still an event, and you could really gear events around more than just the athletics. It could be multiple types of events.
Or other seasons.
Questions from folks I haven't heard from yet. I think it's so true.
Okay. Just a couple things. One, Councilmember Kadabat brought up a point that was running through my mind too, and that's the flooding. It would just be helpful to understand that, like, if there is a connection made between the pond that's out there right now and to the river, what that's going to mean in terms of maintenance costs and whatnot. Just a case in point, up at the Willow Street Park, as you're going down to Alamo Park, where Willow Street comes into the Sky River Park, I'm sorry, it comes into the Sky River, that bank has been moving back and forth. It's a very, very active channel migration area, and it will just be one of those things I'd be concerned about here, concerned from the standpoint of making certain we go into this with eyes wide open about maintaining the hydraulic connection there and sedimentation and rocks and whatnot being moved up against it. So that's something that I'm hoping we'll be able to do. So a couple of other items. One, the city has a tagline of "The adventure starts here." And one of the things that I would acknowledge is that the community may have one set of desires
then it may not be exactly the same as people that would use the facility for tourism, economic development, things like that. So I kind of see that the RV and the tent camping, not just something that would benefit maybe less so the RVs, I don't know, but certainly the tent camping people that live here. But I think that the RVs and also the tent camping, and maybe if I can insert in their yurts, would provide that opportunity for tourism and economic development. Also, it would allow us to help create another anchorage as part of the water trail that the county is working on all the way up the Skyhomish River and then all the way down to the Snohomish River and out. So, I guess I'm doing this is that I do see that tourism component associated with the RVs, whether it's just for events or it's for events and also things like fishing. And I would hope that we would do some sort of feasibility analysis, some sort of business plan to determine what kind of camping would be appropriate there, yurts, tents, RVs, and also what it would look like if you cram in 50, just like Karen was pointing out over here, and that's going to generate one type of revenue and look a certain way versus having 30 out there with their trees in between them. I think it would be important to have some sort of feasibility analysis, some sort of marketing and business plan, where we operate it, where the capital costs that we would have to do it initially, what would be the O&M, would we need to dedicate a couple staff members or a staff member or a caretaker to manage that, and then what sort of revenue would we need to generate. So these are the sorts of things that I would hope before we kind of finalize plans that we would have a better understanding of before we, again, finalize plans.
Yeah, that's it.
I'm afraid not to take it away from the mayor.
No, just to tell you what you said, I mean, that's exactly where I was going, is that it would be, you know, a common spots that were kind of year-round, quasi-year-round, however you want to look at it, and then there would be a location that you would use specifically for events, but there definitely, in my opinion, there could be a tourism, like you were saying, economic component.
So I've got a couple things
on
the pause really quick. Are you good, time-wise?
Building on what the mayor said about ensuring that the proposals that we put forward to the public are feasible. I've had a lot of experience in floodplain communities. This is in the floodplain, and a lot of the things that were mentioned this evening are not going to be feasible in the floodplain. So you can do RVs, but they have to be movable. You can do electrical, but it's got to be 10 feet off the ground. So you're not going to be able to do, I think, a couple of things that were mentioned earlier about yurts, for example, won't be feasible in the floodplain. So let's be very certain that we do that. The other thing that I want to caution, too, is that when you're talking about river hydrology, and I appreciate you raising this issue about that reconnection, is that salmon habitat, and if you begin to bring those that type of use in, the restrictions that you're going to face further on down the road are only going to be more restrictive, and you will not get those active things that you're talking about doing now. So be very, very careful about wanting to make those connections, because they will prohibit future uses. Those regulations are only going to be more prohibitive in the future, not less. And again, going to timing of everything, if those are the types of things you want to do and they're feasible to do now, we ought to get on and get doing them. Because again, in the future, you may not be able to do anything that you're talking about doing now. Not will be feasible. So just keep that in mind.
Question to the back first.
I just want clarification. So you mentioned the Centennial Trail several times. This is not contingent on the Centennial Trail, correct?
As far as I know,
I just want to make sure that we're not dependent on anyone for any development or anything. Okay,
thank you.
I just want to mention of RV. I think it's really important that the purpose for having an RV park is clarified, whether you want to use it for revenue or for service to the community. Because I don't think if you're doing it for revenue purposes, to just opening it up to put RVs in there, you're not going to get the revenue because nobody's going to be willing to pay a high enough price to just park an RV there. And, you know, unless, especially if they're going to be going, I think, if they're going to other events, you're not wanting to pay a high price for an RV place. Somebody might pay a higher price if it's a nice spot with a lot of services and electrical hookups.
Yeah. I think there is a range. I think you guys have brought up that, you know, there's, we're not going to solve, obviously, tonight. So I think if I'm distilling some of it, it's definitely an interest. I think there's lots of opportunities for how you might address it. There's also a lot of feasibility and cost that goes into the range of that. That frankly, within the confines of our master plan, we're not going to answer a lot of those questions. But I think it's important that we raise all those questions. We do look at some feasibility within a floodplain. That is kind of within our purview of understanding what it would mean if we were to do it, the economic drivers of what that means, and how much or how little we do and where you find that balance is probably that next step beyond the master plan. But it's important to say if we want it or not, and then we can kind of be a little bit flexible of how it actually plays out in the future. I think I do want to address a little bit on the floodplain and the flood zone analysis. That is something that we have in particular. We've got some folks on our team from a civil engineering standpoint that did all of the boardwalks and the trails along the Snohomish River through their downtown, and that's great photo of the before the flood, after the flood, and how that develops, lighting and improvements, shoreline improvements. I don't have all the answers now because we have to understand what some of the improvements we want to do are, and then we start to apply how close can we get and what does it mean if we can or can't, and then how much does it cost. So I think that's a really big part of how that works.
Yeah.
Other comments? Questions?
I just wanted to ask about the portage access in relation to the river and the flooding, whether or not that would create another channel for the river during flood time.
Yeah, so we spent quite a bit of time with the flooding and the hydraulic engineers looking at where do we potentially can we be, where do we absolutely not want to be if we're going to try and connect to the river. There were two spots that seemed the most feasible. One was somewhere here. And the other was kind of off this end here. Certainly expanding this is a potential, but it doesn't serve the safety needs. So that's kind of why we showed them in these two spots. Angling it is going to make a difference. I don't know if this is it may not be the right angle, but I know ultimately if we play that, it does. What's happening is this is the worst spot to try and go in, but if you were to go in further up here in the pond and then connect, it would be much better. This is your most active zone of movement that you're currently seeing a lot up here. You're seeing more and more of that going to start happening down here in the long run. This is, at least in terms of where the hydrology is going, is going to get kind of more and more exposed more on this side, and then it comes down into the pots further downstream. So some of those, we're at this point, we're staying away from the most active zones that have the most potential volatility, and trying to focus in a narrower spot where it seems safer and is more feasible. And then we got to figure out what that means and how much it would actually cost to do. Are we taking comments from the public? Or this one?
Okay, Teresa, real quick. I heard you talking about working on the north side of the river.
Can you come to the microphone, please?
Teresa Willard, Monroe, Washington. I hear you talking about the north side of the river channel and how will that affect the property owners on the south side of the river.
And I don't necessarily have the answer to that, but that has been brought up as part of the public process as well. So where and how the whole hydrology of the whole system, upstream and downstream, that we have to, we're not going to know exactly at this level of the master plan, but we have to get into it enough to understand what the potential implications are. And that's about probably about as far as we're going to, as we'll get with this process.
When I sent you the survey, prompted me to look at this now with the water there, Cadman, in regards to fishing, is it possible to stock with fish there, or?
Excuse me, not likely.
Okay.
So a couple of things take effect to it. So you can stock with more, with species that would not, you know,
little words for them, but are not going to influence the native species through the river that aren't what we produce, put it that way. Couple of things affect that though. One is we are going to get, and we do get fish coming in here through the floods, and then they need to have a way out. So that's kind of part of some initial connectivity between the ponds now, but as this starts to develop over time, it's gonna, we need to improve that and make that happen better. The water temperatures of the pond in and of itself mean it's really just not suitable for stocking independently, and it is too closely tied to the river to probably ever want to deal with managing that type of a system.
There's no inlet around that, right?
There is inlets.
There is an inlet.
Oh. There's a couple of inlets into the pond. There is maybe at one point there was an outlet in the system. Not so sure if it's still there now.
Oh, I just want to ask you, Mike Farrell, could you speak to swimming?
Probably want to get your feet wet. What we kind of heard overwhelmingly, and we had some concepts that showed beach, like rock or beach, and those initial concepts. Not so much. Like, this isn't where you're going to go. Lake Tahoe is where you're going to go if you want to go swim in the lake. It's monitored, it's managed, it's got a great big beach, it has all the support facilities really close. We're not entirely sure we can even get a restroom in here. What is that going to look like? How high does it have to be to get it permitted? There's a lot of kinds of issues with utilities and structures and floodplains that make it not always impossible, but certainly more costly to develop. So universally, I think people were like, yeah, I want to get my feet in the water. It's just not where I'm bringing my beach towel and really having, you know, having a day to swim in the water. So right now it is in, it, you know, kayak canoes, floats, paddle boats, a concessionaire that can come and go on a temporary basis. Certainly ways to access the water, but we're not necessarily thinking like really big, pristine beach. And so far, I think as we go through the rest of this process, we'll have to see how that resonates with people as we move through.
Is the water quality even like swimmable? I would think.
You would both start nodding your head, but I don't know if we know the answer to that. I've got like hundreds of documents now on this cabin site, kind of starting to pour through it. I've got some documents that show there was some dumping occurring in some areas historically, and some anecdotal that we actually reinforced in the meeting. You know, it wasn't a dump site, it probably shouldn't be horrible, but I don't know. The pond.
Over more toward Alborland was the kind of a junkyard industrial site. Is any of that the concerns any gas stations by that's going to affect the leakage that's going into the groundwater that could be cooling?
Engineers delve into that background and history to see if there's anything. Again, at a master plan level, my concern is cost. I want to know feasibility, I want to know cost, and I want to know the limitations of how much we can go in the future. So nothing's popped up yet. They're not necessarily done going through all those documents.
And then my last question has to do with the civil engineers and or geologists looking at the river meander over time.
Yes.
And what it's going to affect.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and that is part of what we've started doing as well.
So, just briefly, what are your next steps, and we'll go ahead and wrap up.
Oh, look at that. Here we go. Alright. Thanks, great segue. Next step. Okay, so what we're doing right now, we're working towards this master plan process. We're kind of finishing the alternatives, which was in the pop-up, and this is about a month-long process so we can start to look at the hydrology and the flood with these concepts that we've shown. I haven't heard anything tonight that is completely off-base. I'm hearing definitely continue to pursue the tent and the camping for that open space. And so we'll start to develop that much more. We then would have another open house and then try and finalize the master plan. We start to develop costs with the preferred concept, and then we really get much more detailed when we get into the final master plan along with spacing and implementation.
we let them start to identify what can volunteers do, what can we get grants for, you know, what are the big projects, how much can we save this in the smaller projects. So we start to get into a lot of that in the later phases. Our next discussion with you folks is intended to happen basically between the preferred master plan and the open house. We actually wanted to come back to you with some of the results of the discussion we had today and some of the really refinement of these ideas, then take that out to the open house and then come back to you again with what we heard and how we finalize that master plan. Try to get everything done out of ours by the end of the year, so we've got some ability to still kind of carry into the beginning of the year for the final adoption before grant cycle would come up.
All right. Thank you very much.
So
since this is still a very old city council meeting, I do need a motion to adjourn the floor a little bit. We'll go ahead and accept that as a first.
What do we need to do? What do
Once you fill those out, go ahead and give your reflection.
If you've got to come back, you can hand them to me. If you are taking a call, send them a mic.
Okay. And I, on behalf of the council and myself and staff, thank you, Parks Board, for coming and joining us today. Thank you, everybody, for talking around the room. I think it's really important for us to talk about where it is we'd like our community to go so that we can come up with appropriate funding and get it done. So thank you all for coming here this evening and sharing your thoughts. And we do have a motion on the floor from Councilor Tan, a second from Councilor Gamble to adjourn the meeting. Is there any discussion from the council members? Seeing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed?